But I was thinking on the way over here about how I wanted to start it, and I remembered when I was a little kid, my father told me this story about a speaker in Hyde Park. You know, Hyde Park in London is where all the crazies and the anarchists and the speakers get up to speak. And apparently, sometime in the 50s or 60s, there was a speaker in Hyde Park who was going on and on and on and was saying seditious things, and finally he was arrested. And he was taken away to jail for, I don't know, a year or a year and a half. And then when he was released, he went right back to Hyde Park, got up on his soapbox and said, now, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted. So, as I was saying, here's the plan. We have three sessions before Pesach. I thought what we would do is today go over the Abraham story up till the 21st chapter. Next time, review the 21st chapter, building up to the Akedah, which is both the culmination of Abraham's story and will take several sessions to go over. And then in the third session before Pesach, the one right before Pesach, I think we can talk about the Haggadah and maybe give you some things to say at the Seder. So let's begin by reviewing basically Abraham 12 to 20, or 12 to, yeah, 12 through 20. And maybe even a couple of words about the story before Abraham. Well, yeah, Genesis chapter 12, if you want, but we're going to skip around a lot, so I wouldn't worry too much about where you are. I'll mention where we are. For those of you who have not been in the class before, or those of you who don't remember, you can bring any chumash you want. However, be aware that there are a couple of different kinds of Bibles that you can get. That is, you can get, which is what I recommend, if you're only going to bring, or only going to get one, get a full Tanakh, which has the Torah, the five books, all of the Nevi'im, all of the prophets, and all the Ketuvim, all the writings. So if we make a reference to the book of Ruth, or the book of Proverbs, or Psalms, or Deuteronomy, you will have it, okay? The one that I recommend is the Tanakh, just because it's a modern translation, it's easy to read. And the others that are modern and easy to read, like Robert Alter's translation, which is very good, or Richard Elliot Friedman's, which is very good, they only cover the five books. This is the only one that has the entire Tanakh. So if you're going to get one translation, get this one. If you're going to get a Chumash that is just the five books, or five books with commentary, you have lots and lots and lots and lots of choices. The one we use is the Eitz Chaim, which is the red-covered book that we use in the sanctuary. That's very good. You can get the Stone Chumash, which is a traditional Orthodox commentary. You can get Plautz, which is a traditional Reform, if that's not oxymoronic, but a traditional Reform commentary. You can get anyone that has a full five books. One thing that I don't suggest is that you just bring Genesis, because even though we might make infrequent references to Psalms, Proverbs, other things, you'll want at least the whole Torah there, the five books. Just to review about what it is that I'm talking about in general, the Hebrew Bible is what's called a step canon. A canon is a group of sacred books. A step canon is a group of sacred books where one is more sacred than the other. The five books are the most, considered the most sacred. Then below that is the Nun of Tanakh, which stands for Nevi'im, the prophets. Mostly Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, but also what are called the minor prophets. Minor only because their books are small, not because they're unimportant. Yoel, Ovadia, Amos, and so on. And it also has the historical books of Judges, the Joshua, Judges, Samuels, and so forth. And then finally is Ketuvim, the Kuf of Tanakh, and that's all the writings like Jonah, Esther, Psalms, Proverbs, Ruth, Ecclesiastes, Job, all those books are in the third section. So Tanakh as a whole is all the writings in the Hebrew Bible. Okay? Any questions about that before we move on? Yeah, please. Yes.
So how come you're taking us back?
Because we have to spend several sessions on 22, and I don't want to break it up with Passover. 22 is the Akedah. It is maybe the central story, along with the Exodus, the central story in the Torah. There's been a tremendous amount written about the Akedah. Whole libraries have been written about the Akedah, and there's no way we can do it in just one session. I'll talk more about it later, but we're going to talk about the Akedah in the Hasidic tradition. The Akedah in Kierkegaard, who wrote a very famous book called Fear and Trembling about the Akedah in rabbinic tradition, and also in modern tradition. Yeah.
Why is it read during Rosh Hashanah?
We'll talk about that. So, and Akedah, which is in English the sacrifice of Isaac, in La'aked really means to bind. In Hebrew, it's the binding of Isaac, because Isaac, except according to some midrashim, was not in fact sacrificed. Which is also the occasion of a book that used to be quite well known, isn't so much anymore, by Seymour Siegel, called The Trial, or The Trials of Abraham. The name escapes me for the moment, but it's about a medieval poem that writes, essentially, Abraham, you were lucky because our children are killed and we have to kill our children and your child was spared. So I will bring in The Last Trial, it's called. I'll bring in the copy of The Last Trial as well. There's an awful lot to talk about with the Akedah, so we need to build back up to it. Even the most famous non-Jewish, he was Jewish, but non-rabbinic article about the Bible in general was written about the Akedah by Eric Auerbach, comparing the Akedah and Homer's Odyssey, called Odysseus's Scar. So we'll... I don't know how many sessions we'll spend on the Akedah, but we'll spend a lot on it, and by the end, we still won't understand the story. But we will understand our confusion much, much better than we do now. It's also, by the way, the reason it's called The Last Trial, and this is relevant to what we're going to talk about, is when we get to 21 and then the Akedah, you know that Abraham's life is built according to 10 trials. And what those 10 trials are varies from commentator to commentator. I will, over the next couple times, give you out the sheet that I gave out last year enumerating the 10 trials now that we will have read them all. And some see one thing as a trial and some see another. But the idea to start off with, that Abraham, who is in some ways the pivotal figure in Judaism and is clearly the pivotal figure in monotheism in the Western world, because he is the one figure that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all share and talk about all sharing, the fact that his life is built up of trials, that's how you characterize the life of Abraham, that's the framework that you put it on, says something already about the nature of faith. And the idea that faith is not supposed to be an easy and smooth road. That in fact, from the very beginning, faith is made up of trials, and Abraham, unlike his predecessors, that is Adam, Noah, primarily, but everyone else, the generation of the Tower of Babel, Lemach, all the other figures who precede him in the Bible, Abraham passes the test, which is why he becomes the founder of a great people, even though the strange part of it is that at the very beginning, before he's given any tests, God says to him, you're going to be the founder of a great people, right? You're going to be the founder of a great people. Now let me test you to see if you'll be the founder of a great people. No. The question was, do I believe that all of our personal trials in life are a test of our faith? No, because I have, I really do have I've recommended the book many times. I really do have a Frankl view of this, Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, which is one of like the two or three books that every human being should read at some point in their lives. Very short book, very powerful book. And the essence of Frankl's message which I'm loath to give you because then you'll think that you don't have to read the book because you got the message. But believe me, my summary of it doesn't begin to do justice to the richness of the book. But the essence of Frankl's message is that it's the creation of meaning that gives life purpose, as opposed to the assignment of meaning. And I really do think that God doesn't give you tests with a pre-assigned meaning. And that you might be able to read the Akedah that way, we'll see. But that the quest for meaning in one's life is a quest for the construction of meaning, not for the quest of discovery of meaning. So after the Akedah, I don't know what Abraham said to Isaac, but he could have plausibly said lots of different things because he could have taken lots of different meanings from that story. And the fact that there's so much commentary on it and on every single episode of Abraham's life tells us that meaning is something that is created. In other words, I think of meaning like the Constitution, not like America. That is, America was discovered, but the Constitution was created. Now, the Constitution is what made America great. Before that, it was a landmass. But it was a creation. The Constitution wasn't there waiting for the founding fathers to uncover it. So the same thing about your life. Your life is the given, it's the landmass. But the Constitution is, or the Declaration of Independence better, is what you decide to write. I also think that in some ways the assignment of meaning is I was speaking just recently to a college student who basically came in to see me about the fact that he was searching for the meaning of life. I mean, he didn't quite put it in those terms, but he said, you know, one of the things that I was saying to him, which like a lot of things comes out of conversation. I mean, I didn't know that I thought this before I talked to him, but once I started talking to him, I said, yeah, that must be what I think. It's E.M. Forster said that. He said, how do I know what I think till I see what I say? So there is something to that. What I was saying is that that if you think of life as a series of adventures in which you are constructing its meaning, as opposed to I have found it, now I have to live it out, it's a much less disappointing way to live life. Because otherwise you think there must be some meaning out there or some purpose out there that certain people know that I haven't got yet. As opposed to there's a framework for the meaning. There are certain things that are in my framework of meaning and certain things that are outside of it. Right? There are certain possible meanings of life. I mean, people can come and knock at my door and hand me a pamphlet of the meaning of life and I'll throw it in the trash because I know this is outside my framework. But inside the framework, you just accumulate as much as you can and you keep building. So, and maybe that's why, actually, I didn't know that I thought this till just now, but maybe that's why at the beginning God says to Abraham, you're going to found a great nation, but now I'm going to put you through all these trials because Abraham still has to build in the framework. Even though the framework is he's going to be Abraham, he's not ready to be Abraham in chapter 12. God's just telling him what it is you're going to create of yourself. So in the end, he does. No? Okay. So let's talk about how he does that a little bit. First of all, Abraham is supposed to go to Canaan, but as we discover, although most people aren't aware of it, he was already on his way. His father, Terach, had left his homeland and was on the way and only made it halfway. Made it to Haran, but did not make it to Canaan. He settled in Haran. Then God says to Abraham, you have to leave your homeland and the land of your father and go to Canaan, and Abraham does. So in a sense, he completes what his father had begun. And there is no indication in the Bible, at least, that his father was an idol worshiper or was a bad guy. I mean, you understand why rabbinic tradition made Terach into an idol worshiper, because that makes Abraham's life much more powerful and dramatic. He really broke completely with what preceded him. But maybe he got something from Terach too, since for whatever reason, Terach left the home of his ancestors and came to Haran. So it could be that Abraham already came from an iconoclastic home, literally. You know what an iconoclast is? It's somebody who breaks statues, right? That's what the iconoclasts were in the Middle Ages, the iconoclasts, and after. The iconoclasts were the Protestants mostly who smashed the art and idols of the Catholics. They saw them as idols anyway, because Catholicism was full of iconography, right? Full of visual representations of God, and the Protestants objected to that and became iconoclasts. So Abraham is literally an iconoclast in that story. He breaks all the icons. Who knows, maybe his father was too. And then out of nowhere, without any precursor, without knowing anything about Abraham, without any message as to God's internal workings, as to why he's going to choose Abraham, God comes out of the sky and says to Abraham, I'm going to make you a great nation. Why that is, again, the Midrash, the rabbis tell many stories about Abraham's coming to God. Among them, that he was looking for someone who was responsible for this universe, that he couldn't stand the idea that the world was without a shepherd. And so God came out of the sky like a king in a palace and said, I'm the one who controls this. The interesting thing about that Midrash is that the word that is used is Bo'er or Bo'eret, which can mean that the palace was full of light or the palace was on fire. So maybe Abraham saw the world as beautiful, maybe Abraham saw the world as coming apart, or both. But either way, Abraham was looking for a proof that the world had some stewardship, that it wasn't rudderless, that it wasn't without some design and some purpose. And God comes out of the sky and says, yes, in fact, I'm the design and the purpose. And I want to bring this up also because you'll notice that God proves God's existence to Abraham how in that Midrash? The same way God does in Job, through a personal relationship. Hence the, I don't want to use too harsh a word, hence the mistakenness, although that's not the word that came to me when I read the editorial, of the editorial this morning by Sam Harris in the Los Angeles Times, and of his book where he talks about the fact that people believe things that are not reasoned, and that's what faith is. But faith has nothing to do with believing things that aren't reasoned. It has to do with believing things that aren't subject to reason. The same way that Sam Harris believes that life is worth living, but you can't reason that, right? That's a fundamental article of his belief, which is why he gets out of bed in the morning, but you can't prove it. Now, you can prove, I suppose, that this is green, although that's trickier than he may think. But you can't prove the existence of God the same way you can't prove that life is worth living, because it comes out of experience, not out of a syllogism, right? You can't put it on the board. And to criticize faith for not being reasoned is like criticizing green for not being tall, right? It's a category mistake. Green isn't tall, and faith isn't about coming to more reasoned conclusions. It's about a sort of existential choice. And that's how it's portrayed at the very beginning, right? Abraham doesn't actually reason his way towards God, even though there is this midrash that he thinks that the moon rules the earth, and then all of a sudden the moon disappears, and he thinks the sun rules the earth, but then at night the sun disappears, and suddenly he realizes there must be something greater than the sun and the moon. By the way, on the same notion, interestingly, Stephen Hawking, the famous astronomer who wrote the book that nobody read but everybody bought, that book about A Brief History of Time. I was smart. I didn't even buy it. But anyway, he just this morning, I saw an article that said that he was quite certain and thought that it would be proven that the universe was created from nothing, that there wasn't and this is a huge debate, by the way, in the history of religion and cosmology, whether it's creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing, or there was a pre-existing substance. And by the way, even Jewish thinkers throughout the ages, and this is a huge controversy with Maimonides, have debated about that. But the Bible seems to suggest that God creates from nothing, right? Tohu vavohu, darkness and void, seems to be the Bible's way of saying there was nothing there and then there was something. So, for what it's worth. Yes, please.
I'm struggling to pose this because of sounding blasphemy. That, apropos what you were saying about creating your meaning, but I'm thinking that Abraham created his meaning by creating God in his mind.
Well, you would hardly be the first to suggest that people create God, but I don't have an answer for that other than to say I don't think so. I mean, you know, the only thing I would say about it is that Avraham clearly is not the only one in that world that is convinced of the reality of God. So if Avraham created it, he managed to persuade lots of other people to create it in their minds as well. That doesn't mean that it's impossible. It just means that there is something either innate in human beings or real about the fact that God's there. Is it possible that people create it? Yes. I mean, look, people create lots of things that, or rather, there are lots of things in the world that are agreeable to people that are still real. You know, it would be, I would love it that flowers smell nice. That's, to me, is a beautiful thing, but it also happens to be true. So the fact that God is sometimes agreeable to people, that they would want a God to exist, isn't an argument for or against God. Anyway, yes?
On the subject of whether the universe was created from nothing or something, in the beginning of Genesis, when it says that the earth is
formless and void, right,
with darkness over the surface of the deep and right, wind from God sweeping over the water, what do you do with the surface of the deep?
Well, it depends who you are. If you're Ramban, you say that that's a primary substance, and the Greeks thought so too. But if you want to argue for creation from nothing, which is what the rabbis basically did, then the surface of the deep is just another way of saying is a way of human beings conceiving of the nothingness that existed. But either way, the Torah can support, clearly the words of the Torah could support either interpretation and have for a long time. But if you look in, you have the stone Chumash. What do they say about the deep? I'll tell you what Sarna says about that. That'll give you a traditional read, and Sarna will give you a modern scholar's read. That's chapter 1, and let's see. He has a whole thing about cosmology here, but the deep, the cosmic abyssal, a little bit, no. It's A-B-Y-S-S-A-L, abyssal. Abyssal means a little bit in Yiddish, but this is like the abyss, right? The abyssal water that enveloped the earth. The text says nothing about how this watery mass came into existence. Proverbs 8:22-24 makes it one of God's creations. So he has here, where is it? The issue, I don't want to take too much time on this issue at the moment, but the issue of whether there's creation ex nihilo or creation from something. But he doesn't, it says just says from the primordial state of the world. Anyway, so I'm happy to talk about that in more detail, but in order to do so, I have to tell you a lot more about Maimonides' controversy with it. This was one of those issues where Maimonides said that if science disproved what he understood from the Torah, he would interpret the Torah differently. So, which I, you know, think is way, way ahead of his time. Does Stone say anything about the surface of the deep? Mm. No. Okay. Yes.
Right here in 8:7, it says the creation narrative in the Bible is a document of faith.
Right.
And that's really what it boils down to.
Yes, but the question is it a document of faith of creation from something or document of faith of creation from nothing? Ramban thinks that, Nachmanides thinks that there was what he calls hyla, H-Y-L-A, this primordial substance that God fashioned into a world because he's a mystic. Mm-hmm. But either way, go ahead. Do they? They don't. Okay. I'll take a look at that later. But either way it goes, by the time you get through the early stories to Abraham, God has failed several times to create a world of the kind that we understand God to want. That is a world of goodness, a world of justice. Remember, God fails with Adam and Eve. God fails with the Tower of Babel. God fails with Noah, actually in reverse order, first Noah and then the Tower of Babel. And so the strategy changes And the strategy now is to create one people, one representative people, and to try to fashion them. And Abraham is the beginning of that. So Abraham and Sarah together become this group that is going to now, you should excuse the word, but evangelize, because that's what they do, right? They bring the message of God's word to the world. It is only, by the way, much later in Jewish history that Jews stopped doing that. Initially, the idea is you want to make the world monotheistic, right? That's the whole idea. So you tell everybody about monotheism, and that's what Abraham and Sarah do. They bring a whole bunch of people, as well as Abraham's nephew, and they head off to Canaan. Once they get to Canaan, God promises Abraham the land, but the land isn't ready for him. So he has a whole series of struggles. Among them is famine. And famine as a motive force in the ancient world and in the Bible is constant and powerful. We forget how, in fact, where was I just reading this? I don't remember where it was, but I just recently read an account of, I think it was an account not of the Holocaust, but of a Soviet labor camp. Oh, that's what it was. It was Martin Amis's novel, House of Meetings, which is about a love story in a Soviet labor camp. And again and again, he talks about the fact when people first come into the camp, they think about, what was it? I think it was socialization, sex, and food. The first one wasn't socialization, but whatever it was. He says, then over time, they think about sex and food, and then over time, they only think about food. And food dominates every conversation. It's all you talk about, and it's all you think about. And accounts of the concentration camp were much the same, right? Hunger is all enveloping, and the ancient world was filled with, as is the modern world, but not our modern world, was filled with hunger. And people went where they went out of, you know, the desire to find food. The idea that you could move for a better job or, you know, for opportunity is part of what we lose in reading the story of Abraham. Because God doesn't say go to Canaan because there you'll find food, which is the only reasonable rationale for going from one place to another. If you have food in one place, what idiot would get up and leave and go to a place you've never seen to find food in another place? But Abraham does, and he does because God promises him. But as soon as he gets there, of course, there's a famine, and he has to go to Egypt. And going to Egypt already presages lots of the themes that the Torah will pick up later. First of all, going to Egypt for food, which is, remember how the Jews got there in the first place. Not Joseph, who got there out of sibling rivalry, and we'll have lots of, you know, precursors of that too. But Joseph's brothers go there because there's a famine in the land. And that's how they go and they find Joseph again. And second, there is the idea that you have to be afraid of the governing powers. And that's why Abraham twice persuades Sarah to call herself his sister rather than his wife. And twice gets out of it, but just barely, by either letting the ruler know or having God let the ruler know that in fact Sarah is his wife and not his sister. So when Abraham gets to Canaan, he finds the same thing that, to be perfectly honest with you, the Israelites find when they get to Canaan in Joshua and Judges, which is that this is not a perfect place and has never been a perfect place. And things always go wrong there. I mean, even in the kingdom of David and Solomon, which is like the Camelot of the Bible, right? It's the time when everything is supposed to go right. You know, David's son rebels against him and has to be killed. I was just talking, that's one of two or three times in the Bible. We were talking about this the other night, when hair plays an important part. I don't know why I was thinking about hair. But I was thinking about, on the way, just walking to the executive committee meeting the other night, I was thinking about where is hair mentioned in the Bible? Apart from the section mentioned by Aaron Leibovich, which I had forgotten, about not cutting the corners of your hair, payas, and so on. But I was thinking of it in the narrative, which is Once it's mentioned with Samson, and there it's a source of strength, right? There hair is a good thing, because the Nazir, the person who devotes themselves to God, is not supposed to cut his hair, have sexual intercourse, or drink wine, right? The other place exactly is with Avshalom, with David's son, where hair is a source of vanity, because he's rebelling against his father. And how does he get captured and killed? Because he has this long flowing hair and it gets caught in the branches of a tree. And David's henchmen, against David's orders, find him and kill him because they're frankly smarter than David. David wants to save his son. They want to put down an insurrection. You know, and they're afraid if you leave Avshalom around, you know, you leave a charismatic leader of a rebellion around, then sooner or later he's going to rebel again. So even though David might not like it, you know, we're going to get rid of him. And of course, they do, and then they come to David, and you know, nobody knows what happened. But I bring this up because even in the best moments of the kingdom, David and even under Solomon, maybe briefly, there isn't this perfect place. And that begins with Avraham. And the idea that we have that Israel should be perfect is a construction that has no foundation in history. It's an idea that's, you know, that exists in our imaginations, but not in reality. It's just like when people open the newspaper in the morning and they can't believe that something so terrible could happen, whatever the crime is, ignoring the fact, of course, that it was in yesterday's newspaper and the day before and the day before and 20 years ago and 50 years ago and 100 years ago. But we are perpetually naive about the reality of the world, which is always more difficult than our imaginations will allow us to carry from day to day. And that's certainly true about Israel. As soon as he gets there, there's a famine. Then he gets involved in a war with four kings against five kings, right? And he has to save Lot from a war. And he also has a dispute with Lot, right, over the division of property. Who's going to get which land? So, in other words, fights over money and families, the fact that government is always problematic, that there is no perfect world, that, you know, economics and famine and so on drive people from place to place. It's all there in the story of Abraham, and there is nothing, there's nothing about the contemporary world that should surprise us if, in fact, we're alert readers of the Bible in that. Okay, any questions now? Yeah, Don? For a pope. Oh, for hope. I thought we were talking hierarchy, but instead we're talking hope. Well, the foundation, it depends. You could spin it either way. You could say things have always been bad. Why should you expect they'll get any better? Because the cups have, right, that's why you can spin it either way. Or you could say human beings have always struggled with these things. We still struggle with these things. You can actually point to things that have gotten better. I mean, after all, in Abraham's time, slavery was taken for granted by slaves and owners alike. And it wasn't until fairly recently that humanity maybe didn't abolish slavery. There still exists slavery in sub-Saharan Africa and a couple other places. But even people who enslave today feel obligated to say they don't enslave because they recognize that it's wrong or that it's perceived as wrong even if they do it. And that's progress already. That's the distinction in sociology between being a criminal and being a revolutionary, right? A criminal is somebody who recognizes the legitimacy of the law but breaks it. A revolutionary is somebody who thinks the law is illegitimate. So somebody who trades in slavery isn't a revolutionary. They don't think the law is illegitimate. They're just criminals. And so in that sense, yes, the real issue with human hope and human progress is whether the technology of weaponry outstrips the progress of morality. And that's the issue. If we still only had spears and stones, there would be great hope for humanity. The fact that we have biological and chemical and nuclear weapons makes it, you know, razor's edge. Whether we will be wise enough, considering the enormous power that we wield, to save ourselves. So. Anyway, okay, and on that cheery note, yeah.
I always struggle with when you say, I'm making a boy gadol. So what's the word boy mean?
Goy just means nation. Just means nation.
So
right. Later on, it became, it started to refer to non-Jews, but in Hebrew, it means just a nation. And then later on, Am, which also means nation, is what people started to use for Israel. But Goy originally has no negative connotation. It just means people. So I thought you were going to ask about Gadol, which means large or great. We're still working on that part of it. Okay, let's actually wrap this up with a couple more comments, and then we're going to go back next time to our more usual mode, which is to reread chapter 21 in preparation for 22. All right, after all of this, the one domestic drama that we didn't really cover this time, of course, is that Abraham can't have a child, and all of this is predicated on Abraham's having a child. Right, that's what this is all about, is that Abraham is going to have a child and become a Goy Gadol. So since Sarah cannot have a child, is unable to conceive, and she knows that if she can't conceive, she has virtually no sway in the world, she wants essentially to use a surrogate. We talked about this last time, meaning last semester, it was interesting. Some people think Abraham was the agent that began this. Some people think Hagar was, some Sarah, some God. But whoever began this scheme, it was doomed from the beginning. She was going to have Hagar give birth. Hagar's kid would be legally her child, which apparently is true in ancient Near Eastern law. If your handmaid has a child, the child is legally yours. And then she would have a child to give to Abraham, even though it wouldn't be of her own womb. It's surrogate. She's essentially using Hagar as a surrogate. Except not for her own, I mean, using Hagar's eggs as well as Hagar's womb. And what happens, of course, is that Hagar feels now capable of something that her mistress can't do. Sarah feels that Hagar, she either feels Hagar's attitude has changed towards her, or Hagar's attitude has changed, who knows, or both are true. And maybe she senses an increased warmth between Abraham and Hagar. We don't know that either. But whatever the case is, she decides that Hagar and her child have to be kicked out of the house, which they are once and then brought back, and then again, essentially for good. But in the process of this drama, an angel comes to Abraham and tells him, and to Sarah, and tells him that he will have a child with Sarah. And despite the fact that they initially disbelieve it, and there is laughter in the Bible, which is a rare thing, by the way, not a lot of yucks in the Holy Book. Although there is the argument that Jonah is supposed to be a satire, the entire book of Jonah. Arnie Band from UCLA makes this argument, among others, that the book of Jonah is a satire, but you know, it's very hard to know humor if you're missing the context. So it could be that in the ancient world, people just cracked up when they read Jonah. I don't know. But anyway, so in fact, Isaac is born to Sarah, at which point she has no need of Hagar and her child anymore. Now she's got Isaac, and Isaac and Ishmael become the first siblings that apparently, we don't know the extent to which they didn't get along. We can surmise, but we don't know for sure. It's really Jacob and Esau that show true sibling rivalry. Isaac and Ishmael, I mean, their parents didn't get along, but that doesn't always mean the kids didn't get along. And in an interesting way, it may show also the two sides of Abraham. There is Ishmael, who is powerful and forceful and daring and a hunter, and there's Isaac, who's quiet and studious and pious, and both of those are elements of Abraham's character. We see it in Sodom, right, where God is going to destroy the city of Sodom and Amorah, and Abraham argues with God, which takes tremendous fortitude, chutzpah, to say to God, you know, what you're doing isn't right. But Abraham does it. Which also, by the way, of course, when we get to the Akedah, puts the Akedah in particularly poignant relief, because here God tells him to sacrifice his son, and he says nothing. Whereas before, God said, I'm going to kill all those other people unrelated to you, and Abraham argues. So why doesn't he argue about his son? We'll have lots of answers to that question. And yet he's unable to save the city, despite that. And then there is that moment when, and maybe we'll close with this, and then next time we'll do chapter 21 also, because I want to make an advertisement. There's that moment where Lot's wife looks back and turns to a pillar of salt. Those of you who read Daniel Mendelsohn's book, The Lost, with the search of six for 6 million, that very extraordinarily powerful book, and he will be here, of course, to speak about it on Yom HaShoah. He intersperses the book. If you want to hear about the book, you can just get the tape from the last Lunch and Learn. I went through the book. It's a long read. I don't want to kid you. It's not zippy. If you're going to read one of the two books, read Man's Search for Meaning. It'll take you less time. However, Mendelsohn's book is incredibly powerful, and the most powerful part of it is the last 50 pages. So you have to read the 450 pages, which have wonderful moments and powerful moments and are beautiful in many ways, but all I can tell you is don't stop in the middle, because if you stop in the middle, you won't really get to what is most poignant about it. Anyway, he says he read through various commentaries, but he didn't find, although this does exist actually in Jewish commentary, he didn't find what mattered to him about Lot's wife looking back, which is that the salt clearly represents tears, and that the habit of always looking back drives you to despair. And that's how he saw it, because after all, that's what he did, was he went back to find six people who had died. And actually, what is remarkable about the book is, from the time he was a little kid, he was told that he looked like Uncle Shmuel, who was the one of the brothers that died in the Holocaust, because he came out of Eastern Europe and he went back for business. And so he and his children died, and he wanted to find out, this is now 60 years later, he wanted to find out what happened to those six people. And what is most amazing is he actually, though he goes all over the world to do it, to Copenhagen, to Israel, to Bolochov, to the village there, he manages actually to find out almost exactly what happened to them, where it happened to them, how it happened to them. But I'll close with this, what is most beautiful about the book is he doesn't just resurrect their deaths, he resurrects their lives. And that's part of the pain of the victims of something like the Holocaust, which is what we know about them is that they were killed in the Holocaust. And what we don't know about them is he says, this one was known for having pretty legs. She died at 16. Nobody would ever know she had pretty legs had he not written the book. But that's actually her life. And this one was going out with a non-Jew, and how she was going out with a non-Jew and what that relationship meant, I'll leave you to discover in the book. But that's part of the pathos of the book, is that it's not just about how they died, but about how they lived. And part of what I think is so powerful about the Bible, if you actually read it, instead of just hearing sermons about it, is you see real living, breathing people. If you read Abraham's story, he's not just a pious figure anymore, right? And the same thing is true with Sarah. These are real people who are defined not by the way we sort of entomb them with piety, but the way they were, as living, breathing human beings. So, yeah, any final questions? The book is called The Lost by Daniel Mendelsohn. He's going to be our, it just won, it not only won the National Jewish Book Award, but last week it won the National Book Critics Circle Award. So it won both a Jewish award and a general award. If you want to see the pictures from that book taken by his brother, Matt Mendelsohn, which are extraordinary, go right now to the Mirage Gallery. We just hung them. I was there with a hammer. And it reminds me of David Brenner, the comedian, has this routine about, he says, when I was a Jewish boy, my mother used to say, hammer, bad, book, good. He said, I've grown up my whole life hammering in nails with a book. But I can see my wife is over there looking at me. I know what she wants me to say. She wants me to tell you that everything that gets fixed around the house gets fixed by her, which is true. I can screw in a light bulb, but that's about the extent of my domestic. When something breaks, my daughter brings it to my wife. How's that? She says, Mommy, will you fix this? Daddy can't fix it. But you can go and see the pictures that Matt Mendelsohn, his brother, who will also be here, took, they're amazing photographs, and they document the story all along the way. And they, of course, become even more poignant if you read the book. Any other questions, comments? Yes, please.
I have two questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
The first, we were talking about whether it's the palace filled with light and the palace filled with fire, or, you know, the God covering over the surface of the deep. How much of a factor is the translation that we're...
It can be a big translation. The fire one is the Midrash. You can translate it either way. Translation is a huge factor, especially because there are some words in the Bible that we just don't know. They're what's called hapex legomena. And hapex legomena is a term that I've only heard used in biblical studies. It means a word that occurs once. The way you know the translation of most of the words in the Bible is either through tradition, through the Talmud or whatever, or because they occur in a couple different places so you can sort of figure it out. But there are some words that occur once that we have to guess. So the book of Job is notoriously impossible to translate, and people argue about every single word practically. The translation matters a lot, which is why in the Jewish tradition, as a rule, the translation is taken to be what the rabbis say it is. But in modern scholarship, now that we have other ancient Near Eastern languages open to us, Akkadian and Ugaritic and Sumerian, now we actually know the meaning of some words in ways that the rabbis didn't, because they didn't have those languages. I mean, it's amazing to know that only in the past 100 years have we all of a sudden discovered huge treasure troves of documents in languages that are cognate to ancient Hebrew. It's like discovering French and Spanish 1,000 years from now and trying to figure out what English is. And so it has changed our approach to the Bible a lot.
The second question I had is, what are some of the thoughts on how God experiences time?
That's a big one. Well, the answer is God doesn't experience time. God is above time. 1,000 years in your sight are like a day, Psalm 90 says. Time is a human experience.
The relationship between past, present, and future. And I was reminded that wonder this when you were talking about when God reveals himself to Abraham. That's a very big moment.
It's a big moment for Abraham. It's a big moment for Abraham, but it may not be a big moment for God. Any Jewish philosophers who think about it say that all time is present to God at all moments, which is why, as my father pointed out to me, I began with my father this morning, so let me close with him. He pointed out to me years ago that in Christianity, because God is born, central holidays are events in the life of God. God's birth, God's resurrection, God's death. But because God doesn't have a lifespan in Judaism, the central holidays are events in the life of human beings. Shabbat is actually an event in the life of the world. It's when God stops creating, but that means the world, that's something for us, not for God. Passover is an event in the life of the Jewish people. You know, Yom Kippur is an event in our spiritual lives, but none of it is because this happened to God or that happened to God, because everything, all time, is the same to God, and nothing changes. So, all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.